Welcome back to Friday. I don't know how many Fridays this has been now. Chip Weismeyer in our closed off quarantine. Is this week number six, I think, in lockdown on quarantine?
It feels like 66.
It certainly does. But in any event, it's time for another DC Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris. That's Jim Weismeyer. Also, welcome, Annalisa Laca.
How are you?
Doing great, despite the isolation. So a lot of news moving this week that has kept us, it's kept us all busy this week, hasn't it, Annalisa?
Yeah, it's the week that doesn't ever want to die, in my opinion.
Indeed. So we're all going to be joining Jim in a drink to toast the end of this week, yeah.
Yeah, all of you, not me. Unfortunately.
Well, Jim will have yours, so we'll celebrate here at the end of the recording. Well, let's dig into the biggest news of the week, probably, Jim, and that is that Congress finally got its act together and passed nearly $500 billion in additional funding for various aid packages. Probably most of note for agriculture is more funding for the Paycheck Protection Program, $60 billion of that set aside for small lenders. What do we need to know about the provisions of that extension, Jim?
Well, on ProFarmer.com this weekend, I am really going to detail some of those, John, so make sure the listeners know that, both for the update on the Paycheck Protection Program and an update for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, the EIDL. But we know for sure that farms and other ag enterprises are eligible for this aid. So that's very good news. And we've got, as you said, $322 billion more for the Paycheck Protection Program. And I think you also said the $60 billion for the EIDL. Now, we don't know how long that's going to last, but at least we got additional funding.
So $60 billion for small lenders. Is it $60 billion also for EIDL that's included in that?
EIDL, I'd have to go back to my thing. It's a chunk of change there. It might be 50. I want to say 50, but I'll have to go back to my thing.
Well, we could circle back to that, but this was big news for agriculture because there were conflicting messages in the first CARES Act about whether or not farms were eligible for the economic the EIDL program. But this states very clearly that farms are eligible. Now, whether or not that's a good option, you're going to have to talk with your banker about that. It is primarily a loan program, although you can have up to $10,000 of it forgiven. But I think that's what only, Annalisa, I think $1,000 per employee that you can get forgiven on that. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that you cannot use the funds, like you cannot apply for the PPP and the EIDL and use the funds for the same expenses. So you cannot use your payroll for PPP and then also try to use all of your payroll for EIDL. That's not allowed within the program. So that's another important point for particularly for farmers who are trying to take advantage of both programs. It's an important piece to keep in mind.
Yes,
and John, I did look in. It does provide an additional $60 billion for EIDLs, and it makes clear again that ag producers with 500 or fewer employees are eligible for the disaster loans. But because EIDLs are being implemented via the pandemic-specific regs, most people say that SBA is going to still be issuing guidance on how agriculture can access those, disaster loans.
Yeah, which creates all kinds of problems because we hear from a lot of farmers who are trying to take advantage of either one of these programs, and they get told by their bankers that they're not eligible or that the banks don't have the rules yet, don't have enough information yet to make the application. Yet at the same time, we talked to Paul Neve for this afternoon from Clifton Larson Allen. He was on Farm Journal Live, and he said, if you don't have your application in Monday, don't bother because the money's going to be gone. So it makes it really difficult to get that application done when even your bankers don't have the information they need to make the application.
Well, I know my nephew, who's in the engineering industry, had his work done very early and last time, and they had run out of funding, but now he's on the list, and I think he's going to be, it was approved, So all he has to do is go back in. But yeah, this funding goes fast, John.
Indeed. Do you have something to pitch in there, Annalisa?
Yeah, what I was just going to say is that the application process for the EIDL is really quick. And so if you talk to your banker and I would also recommend talking to your accountant about it, and they give you the green light, then it takes less than 10 minutes to fill out the application online. There's very few metrics and such that are required to include in the application. So it's really a quick process. So like you guys both just said, find out today if that's something that you should be doing, and do it today if you can. And I don't know that, it's still unclear whether any of the actual application process is even available yet for farmers. So I think, time will have to tell to some extent. But I would just keep checking back until with the SBA website until that eligibility for farmers has been included and the application will let you proceed. Because previously you could go to the website, you could fill out your information, but as soon as you indicated that you were a farmer, the system would kick you out.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting.
And they can they can apply directly with SBA as well for an EIDL.
Right.
Yes, that's what I was just mentioning. Yep.
Yeah.
And to your point earlier, Annalisa, make sure that before you start that process, you have thought through what losses you want to certify through EIDL and what losses you may want to certify through PPP, if any. Said, you cannot apply the same loss on both programs.
No, and you only have to use 75% of the PPP funds towards payroll. You can use 25% of them to do other things. So it's important to kind of map out which money you're going to spend where before you apply.
All right. Jim, anything else in this legislation that was passed by the House yesterday, signed by the president today, that ag needs to take note of?
No, it's mainly for ag. We're going through the aid program that they announced last Friday.
Well, then let's talk about what's not there and still no assistance for the ethanol industry. Where do we stand with that?
Well, the grand package now will be whatever you want to call it, number four, number five, not just ethanol, but a whole series of industries, and including agriculture, who wants more, and I think for good reason. They're going to be lobbying. They are lobbying to be included in this upcoming package, but it's going to be a Donnybrook. If you think this last one, whether it was called, again, 3.5 or number four, was anything, you haven't seen anything yet, because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, is putting on a pause button here, saying that we ought to look back now and assess. It looks like around $9 trillion combined congressional funding and Federal Reserve authorizations via various what they call facilities. So I think you have some merit there. But once the Senate comes back officially May the 4th, it's going to be the big push to spend more money.
Yeah, and while the previous rounds have remained somewhat focused because they were must-pass policies, there was no argument on whether or not they needed to do the individual payments to taxpayers and expanding the PPP program and stuff like that. Now we're to a point where I think everyone's seeing this as, okay, this next round is going to be the last chance to get your priority done. And so this is the one that's really going to get Christmas treed up, isn't it, Jim?
Absolutely. And you have even differences between the parties. You've got Trump and some on the Democratic side want a big infrastructure, spending program. Again, Mitch McConnell is a little more lukewarm regarding that. And that would be a lot of money. Again, I'm not saying it's not needed. And then you have the very controversial the push by the Democrats for a lot of money being spent at the state level, and some pushback on the part of some Republicans to say, if it's for healthcare areas, that's fine. But if it's to bail out states, bankrupt states, if you will, like Illinois, he is going to fight that.
Yeah, in fact, to the point saying that you'd rather see states be allowed to go bankrupt rather than providing additional aid. And I've got to admit, to a degree, he has a point because, you know, this could be seen by some states, like you mentioned, Illinois, which you and I know all too well, has a long, long-term pension mess. And, you know, should the federal government be helping clean that up rather than just addressing coronavirus issues?
I agree. But there's all sorts of problems going the bankruptcy route. So
you're right.
I think Mitch McConnell just was the shot across the bow, but they're not going to go the bankruptcy route. You'll see some additional billions and billions of dollars at the state level, but never enough to satisfy individual states that just cannot control, you know, their individual budget prior to the pandemic.
And as you mentioned, we're at some $9 trillion now. That's combined with Fed action and congressional action, which begs the question, what is the limit of what government can do without making the overall economic problem worse down the road?
Well, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, says whatever it takes. And so far, we've seen that, John. There does come a point where the overall market, relative from a deficit to GDP ratio, gets more than concerning. Again, once this is all over, and it will be all over, then we're going to have a hangover when we look back and see as the rising deficit accumulated to the debt and what it's going to take in the future for your kids and their kids to deal, you know, with this. We're going to have to go through a lot.
Indeed. And looking to add on to that, a number of lawmakers have signed on to a letter calling for another $50 billion in aid for agriculture. Jim, does that happen, or is this just pushing for something else?
Well, I think a portion of that is going to have to happen. It's really what I call a message bill that you'll recall Senator John Hoeven, Republican from North Dakota, tried to get the current Commodity Credit Corporation borrowing cap, which is currently $30 billion, up to $50 billion. And the Democrats, primarily in the Senate, would only go along for $14 billion increase. So you're going to need more. It's clear relative to the livestock, dairy, and specialty crops. If they do change, which I think they will eventually modify the payment limit specifications that's on these direct payments. Again, I'm not quite sure whether they'll modify for the grains, but definitely they're going to have to either totally eliminate a payment cap for the livestock, dairy, and specialty crops, because it doesn't take that large of an operation to hit those. So that's why I call it primarily a message bill. But I don't want to get too complicated, because there's a series of bills. It's just not one bill. One of the bills by Representative Austin Scott, he's Republican from Georgia, would provide $50 billion on top of what is currently in the CCC. And then what's currently out there is $9.5 billion plus $14 billion, remember, provided by that Phase 3 legislation, plus $9 billion that was in the CCC balance. Now, that would mean $82.5 billion, you know, when you add up all that. There's your high water mark there.
Okay,
I don't
wow.
think that's going to happen. But now a second Scott bill would strike the $30 billion in CCC borrowing authority language and inserts $50 billion. And the two bills work in tandem.
$50 billion appropriated, you mean?
$50 billion borrowing authority.
Oh, 50 borrowing. Okay.
Yeah. Borrowing authority. And then the other provides, more money to get through. So it's a little murky right now, but the clear message by commodity groups, agricultural bankers, by the way, to both the Trump administration, USDA, which has a lot of latitude relative to the payment cap, provisions here, get more money involved in this package, and also, you know, boost the CCC borrowing authority, because you had the Farm Bureau coming out, I know, on AgriTalk earlier this week. You had Zippy Duvall saying that when you look at that $30 billion cap adjusted for inflation, it should be $67.5 billion. I think the debate is well underway right now. So it's going to go up. I just don't know how much, John. And this crescendo of letters that you saw, almost half the members of the House are eventually going to sign off on two bills recommending changes in this payment cap relative to this, what we call the CFAP, the Ag Disaster Relief Bill, relative to the COVID-19. That speaks a lot right there. That shows you. And agricultural bankers are clearly calling in to the administration saying, you got a problem if you don't change this. And we do have time, because USDA has to put out the rule to implement the $19 billion COVID-19 aid package, and that's $16 billion, remember, in direct payments and $3 billion in purchases of ag products. And there are a lot of messy areas here that we simply do not know the answers to. Like, one question I kept on getting this week was from the cotton industry, is how is USDA going to treat cotton committed to marketing pools but unsold as of January 1, you know, with the COVID-19 program? Everyone wants to know that. Now, my best sources are saying, I know the cotton industry and lawmakers in cotton states are asking that for each co-op marketing pool, see what percent of the 2019 crop in the pool was priced or sold as of January 1, and then the remaining percentage would be eligible for assistance. So all producers in the pool would report that same percentage of their 2019 crop as still at risk, but not priced on January 1. It looks like that's the way they're going to go, but we need official details in the implementation of this.
Yeah, and it's just a really weird reasoning circle here. You've got these payment caps. It's $125,000 per individual per commodity, $250,000 total per individual across all commodities. Those numbers are a function of that $16 billion pool that's available for direct payments. And so that cap is essentially a result of the funding that Congress allowed USDA. Now Congress is saying they don't like those caps that they, in effect, put into place because they didn't provide fully the funding that was needed for this disaster aid program.
Yeah. Yes. And USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue not taking the initiative to, as part of this package, to utilize the $14 billion of increased CCC borrowing authority that he can use beginning no sooner than July 1. So he could have put together a package that included that. So he could have had up to $14 billion more to work with, but he chose not to. So, you know, that's part of the problem there too, as well. And so this is why they had to live. If he's not going to use that $14 billion, they had to come up with something in order to stretch the program out. And that's probably why they did what they did on the payment, cap limit.
Well, I think he didn't use that $14 billion because he knows he's going to need more in his pocket as the months go on. So he didn't want to expend it all at that point, in hopes that they could pressure Congress to get more authority in there. But Annalisa, this in your dairy industry, this is particularly painful there, isn't it, with this $125,000 payment cap?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think most farmers feel more insulted than helped by the $125,000 payment cap. I mean, when you think about even a medium-sized dairy, but particularly when you look at a large dairy, I mean, this does not provide them relief for more than a week.
Yeah, what we've got in Pro Farmer this week with a CFAP indemnity of, for example, $8.75 per hundredweight, 60% of the dairy supply will hit the limit in 3 weeks or less.
Wow.
And dairies with 2,500 cows or more, that's roughly 35% of the dairy supply, would hit the limit in a week or less. In other words, they goofed up.
Well, and Dermot Hayes from Iowa State on AgriTalk this week, talking about the pork industry, said flat out, this is a joke. Those were his words. You know, that 125,000, you know, while it's nothing to sneeze at, in the grand scheme of what's going on in the pork industry, does very little to resolve any problems there. Jim, you said on AgriTalk this morning, you're very confident that those caps are going to be lifted?
Very confident. I don't know whether totally, but it will be modified. Yeah. The message is loud and clear. Bipartisanship, agricultural bankers, CEOs at bankers calling into the White House. They were supposed to have a conference call with Trump sometime this week. And frankly, I didn't have time to see whether or not that transpired. But if the thought was there, that shows you the seriousness of this line. And you saw what looks to be three letters from Congress on this subject, bipartisan. And then you had the NCBA putting out their letter on that. And of course, what you just heard from the hog producer side. Yeah, it's just, this was not well thought out.
So does that put CFAP in the same place as PPP, where there's a mad rush to get the dollars before they're gone?
You know, we need to see the details. Sonny Perdue had indicated he wanted sign up to begin in early May, with payments beginning in late May to early June. But there's also a murkiness in how the second calculation of those payments would work out, the time frame, things like that. But you're right. This money is just going to pour through like it's in a drunken sailor's hands, that they're going to have to come back. And Mike Conaway, who's the ranking member on the House Ag Committee, Republican from Texas, he hit the nail on the head when he called this aid program an important down payment. Yeah. But he said it's absolutely necessary to see farmers and ranchers through the crisis. You had many, many people told me agriculture was being nitpicked. Again, this is a $19 billion program, and yet you hear the word nitpicked, but they're probably right, because the pay limits, especially, I say again, on livestock, dairy, and specialty crops, are what one person told me was unconscionable. The help applies only to that portion of a crop that was not marketed. Totally goes against Ag Secretary Perdue's view that these programs should not impact producers' decisions.
Yes. Yes.
So it's just, bottom line, here you have the Treasury Department with the SBA program in Congress pumping trillions of dollars into the economy to head off a Great Depression, and agriculture is being nitpicked, if you want to call $19 billion nitpicked. Some are.
And not totally unfairly, I'd say.
Not unfairly at all, because you're seeing the impact. We were in a cash flow bind, working capital, before this started. Mm-hmm. That we've talked many times on this program, before. So it just adds to the seriousness, and that's why you're seeing the bipartisan fervor now in Congress on a number of ag-related issues. And we can bring back the ethanol side, too. Yeah, they were late coming in with their program. I really think that hurt them. But still, that doesn't mean they shouldn't get assistance when you're seeing a caving in of that industry. So they're going to make a good run at some type of payment to aid them. And anyone who says that they can't tap the CCC to help out the ethanol industry does not know the history of the RFS, because in the early, early days, they used the CCC Charter Act relative to that program.
Really? Hmm. Iowa Ag Secretary Mike Naig was on AgriTalk this week and had what I thought was an interesting observation, and this ties in where we're going to head next with all that's been going on with meat packers this week, and it kind of ties what we've been talking about and that together. And he talked about how this is going to bring a longer discussion about food security in this country. And up to this point, when we think food security, it's been mostly about biosecurity. And you know, is our food system vulnerable to some bio attack or things like that? And I don't think there's been as much thought about what we're experiencing right now, and that is just the security of our ability as a country to feed ourselves, to be able to reliably produce enough food for everyone in the country that is affordable, that is safe, that is healthy. And we're really getting a lesson in that right now, aren't we, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. And you'll recall on the prior one when we had Representative Crawford on, you know, Signal to Noise, more the biosecurity. Yeah. But now we've seen what a pandemic will do. And yeah, I think it's going to significantly change the system. And relative to the meat processing industry, I noted on AgriTalk, and I want to emphasize it here again, we still do not have guidelines released for the meatpacking plant workers by OSHA. You talk about behind the curve on this one. You have the United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW, have their international union said that the food supply is at risk, and they want to see how plants are going to adapt from the food service to the retail change, and how they're going to make sure that their workers are in safety and things like that. Yeah, longer term, if I want to interview the board members on meat processing facility companies, because they're going to be under the gun, and I know they'll be asking questions. Never again should this happen to our industry. And to make that happen, what do we have to do? And well, that's going to have to be rolled out.
Well, it is, and at least we're not seeing any sort of centralized direction, whether it's from the CDC, from anywhere in the federal government, or even a trade association, about how these packing plants should have a strategy to stay open and keep their workers safe at the same time. It's like, quite frankly, everything else that's happened, it's been ad hoc, state by state, in this case, plant by plant. And in my opinion, this is really hurting the packing industry, that there is no direction from the federal government of, okay, this is how the industry can really protect itself and protect the food supply and protect the workers there.
Yeah, to be fair, CDC did send a list of recommendations to Smithfield, I believe it was yesterday. So CDC has not been completely silent on this. But
no, they've been completely silent, but there is no master plan from anywhere to, okay, you know, we've got an idea of how to address this problem.
Yeah, we need a five-point plan out there. Number one, get these quick 15-minute tests in necessary quantities out to every meat processing plant. And if you don't have enough of those, which I think they should, but if they don't, then you have to make sure that there's enough nearby or adequate labs to do those tests in a fairly timeline fashion in order to get the results. Then you would think they had an obvious, meaning the federal government, had an obvious research tool at their disposal by these plants that were shut down. They could have quarantined all the workers and then tested them relative to, number one, if they had the disease, you would have had to quarantine them at least, 14 days, probably 21 is better, what the research has pointed out. That would have given us excellent research material. But I think this is also probably an issue of they don't have enough diagnostic labs in the Midwest to have the fast turnaround time or on the test. And it's not test. You have to have the PPE, the equipment, you know, for the workers and things like that. But we've just listed a series of things that just didn't occur. You know, it just didn't occur. And the early days of this, we just have the statements, our food supply is safe. It's not at risk. Well, I don't know whether the supply is adequate, because you're already seeing runs on meat, mm-hmm. as a result of not only the run up in prices, but in the logistics. When you shut down as many of pork and beef facilities as we have, it's just going to, have logistical problems. We've seen the story before.
Well, I think what we're hearing out of Kansas, they're considering providing housing and food for these workers, both to isolate those who were infected and also to isolate those who aren't, that are still able to go to work. And I think that's pretty intriguing and worthwhile. I mean, these are essential workers. We've seen support for the nursing community, as we well should, for the medical community, for grocery workers, et cetera. Why wouldn't we want to do that for those in the packing plants and other food processing who are essential to making sure that the country gets fed? Why not provide safe housing for them where they can stay away from infection and get fed and cared for and treated like the essential workers that they are?
Makes absolute sense to me. Again, that way you need a strategy. And Mike Pence has done a very good job on the White House task force. But and he's from Indiana. He knows agriculture. I just don't think that they have focused. And I know they had so much on their plate, John. And I'm not saying ag was important, was not important to them. But I think that they just need to focus on this food distribution system, especially as it relates to meat, because in the point of hogs that we brought out on AgriTalk, they are far more detrimental from a market and delivery aspect because of the nature of the animal, as opposed to cattle, where you can do certain things in a longer period of time, et cetera. And that's why the hog industry, in a nice way, said this is just not enough direct assistance for our industry, because you're seeing calls for just the euthanasia, all sorts of things. And that's because of a lack of a strategy from the get-go on the part of the combination. I'm not going to let the industry totally off the hook there, but also the task force at the White House, and then at USDA, who has quality people to do this. I'm just not quite sure why they didn't do it.
I was just going to say, I think one important thing to keep in mind here is that absolutely the majority of Americans, for sure the majority of politicians and even most farmers, don't understand the unique dynamics that are at play inside these packing houses. They don't understand the socioeconomic status of these workers, and they don't understand the pressure that workers feel, even though they're being told not to come to work if they feel sick, to still come to work. And I think that there's some major issues at play here that are causing this to happen. And I completely agree that we haven't done enough to address it as a whole. But I also think that it's on these companies to also address it at their level.
I think you're absolutely correct. And for the future, because this may happen again, so we're going to have to learn from lessons. But also, some people call it a bribe. I don't. There should be an immediate kick in of hazard pay if you have a pandemic announced, where that could give the economic incentive for an individual who works there to say, okay, hopefully I can take actions, and the company that I'm working for will take actions to protect me. But there should be the immediately inclusion of hazard pay in instances where you have an official declaration of a pandemic.
And that hazard pay continues if you test positive and are unable to work.
Yes. Well, it should go. They should get it.
Yeah,
they should
exactly.
Still get that hazard pay. Yes.
Yeah, Annalisa, I know you've been following this story extensively this week, and I think it's worth noting that our reporting on AgWeb and on Milk Business and elsewhere reflects only a portion of what we've been working on this week, because there are so many wild rumors flying around about these packing plants right now.
Yeah, it's really incredible the level of rumors that are spreading. And I think just like anything else, when people are afraid and when people fear the outcome of what might be in the future, then it's easy to spread rumors. I mean, we've heard things as crazy as like, oh, there was a group of people from China that were visiting a Smithfield plant a week before this broke out in Sioux Falls. I mean, just like wild, wacky things.
Yeah,
I think that's all human nature.
It is, and it makes our lives very exciting as we try to well, as we do on this show, separate the signal from the noise. And this week there's been a lot more noise than there has been signal, but there has been some significant signal this week as well. Well, speaking of signal, Jim, some news from China this week that they've got plans for some big buys. But yet again, as we've seen, the markets are waiting for the ships to float before they really react.
Yeah, well, they're good. I think it's more than half true. So let me give it a 60 to 65% truth test here. I don't know about the quantities, but there was the chatter was Chinese officials were discussing big purchases of ag commodities to boost China's reserves. And it included purchases of 10 million tons of soybeans, 20 million tons of corn, 1 million metric tons of cotton and sugar, and 2 million metric tons of soy oil. Now, certain people believe that most of those rumored purchases, John, may be fulfilled through imports to implement phase one of the trade deal with the U.S. Now, that's very intriguing if that's true. You saw some movement up. What were we up three straight days in the soybean market? But it would be a shot in the arm if even 60% of those quantities were correct.
Indeed, much needed. And it may be needed this year more than anything. But let's end on some good news. Planting progress seems to be going very well in not all parts of the country, but in a lot of the country. I think we're going to see a big jump Monday when we see those planting progress numbers come out Monday afternoon from USDA.
Well, even my cousins in Southern Illinois are getting in the fields, and they haven't had that for the last few years. So, yeah, we're going to see a big, big bump, and that's good. Yeah, you get the seed in the ground. It just lifts your spirits, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of topsoil and subsoil moisture. So if they get the seed in the ground, it can get off to a good start.
Yeah, what are you hearing, Annalisa?
A lot of the same. Farmers are in the field, happy to be in the field, praying that we don't have kind of a false start like we did last year where we got these crops in the field and then we had to replant a lot of them. So there is some concern about that, but I don't think a ton. I think, you know, one of the things that we have to be mindful of always is that this is normally a really exciting time for farmers, and there will be some of that, but there is also a lot of concern and a lot of worry about, you know, the cost of putting these crops in and the cost of the inputs in and what they're going to get out of it. You know, I did hear from one farmer saying, like, I don't even know why I'm doing this. It doesn't even make sense to put this crop in the ground. But they'll do it because that's what they do. And then I think, you know, also particularly in portions of the upper Midwest where farmers are focused mostly on providing feed for their cows, we're seeing some alternative crops that we don't see traditionally planted being planted in place of corn. So things like oats going in because they can get some additional tonnage off of those and the input costs are a little bit cheaper.
And, you know, John, we didn't mention it, but I think Secretary Perdue did take the right policy decisions when he did not announce allowing in for those dairy producers who did not go into the dairy program. And two, he did not announce any supply management program because, frankly, some of the management programs are ongoing by individual processors to begin with. So on that side, most veteran policy analysts would say he did the right thing.
Yeah, indeed. And Annalisa, I get your point about the psychology of putting in a crop that you don't know you know, what the benefit is going to be in the end of a crazy year like this. But I do think there, in the farmers I've talked to, there is a big psychological boost in just planting is such a sign of being back to normal. It's this relief of, hey, at least something is back the way it should be. And particularly in this year when we talked to Pam Johnson this morning on AgriTalk on the free-for-all, who said, you know, the soil is probably the best she's ever had to work with. And so it's going in nice and easy. I talked to a friend in eastern Illinois, east central Illinois, day before yesterday, said he was 80% done already. So there is some psychological relief there, and I think in getting back to normal and it having a comparatively easy planting season compared to what we've had the past few. In fact, Pam Johnson, before we went on the air this morning, said they keep almost hoping for rain so they can take a few minutes to rest because they've been going at it so hard trying to get the crop in the ground. They want that rain just for an excuse for a little bit to catch up.
And those who are recurrent listeners of AgriTalk know that Pam Johnson has had trouble the last few years getting in her crop. So when she says it's some of the best ever, wow, that was a statement.
Yes, it was. And so a nice warm welcome spot in some otherwise gloomy news this week. So I think we'll wrap it up there with that positive note, other than,
well,
as we do
one
always.
One thing, John, I did want to point out that we finally got the data on the 2019 crop breakdown between the ARC and the PLC, because it was odd. USDA earlier this week gave us acres, you know, enrolled, and but they didn't do any breakdown. It's just some odd things going on at USDA. Finally, I kept bugging them all week saying, you got to have this data. Well, they just shut me up probably. They sent it to me. And we had just shy of 70% in the 2019 crop took up the PLC, and little over 26% for the ARC County. And I noticed just shy of 4% took them up on the ARC IC, the individual county, and that was a result of if you had the all of your crop, you know, that you couldn't plant it, areas of Ohio, Nebraska, I know, portions of, you know, North Dakota. But those are the numbers, and that speaks market sense, that usually the lower you think prices are going to go, it tends generally to favor PLC. And farmers are clearly saying with 70% of the crop choosing that. Let me look at corn. 75.5% of corn base chose the PLC. That's an attitude thing, that they know the price rallies are not going to be that significant.
Yeah, indeed. All right, well, before Chip Flory jumps in here and starts chewing on us for tying up his studio, Annalisa, where are you going to be looking for signal this week?
I don't know what I'm paying attention to. I feel like there's too many things going on that you require attention. I don't know. Watching for sure, obviously, still watching the milk market. We saw a little bit of, we'll call it slippage again this week. We slid lower in most contracts. So still watching that, hoping that we find a bottom there soon. And then also, you know, waiting to see, as Jim mentioned, we do expect that those payment caps will be lifted, which will be much appreciated news by most people. So looking for that. And then also just waiting to see what the rule is and see how we calculate those direct payments to farmers, particularly in the dairy space.
All right, Jim, where are you watching for signal?
Well, I'm going to signals, of course, on this China thing. I'm going to try to get some more of our, you know, Pro Farmer China watchers to comment on, give us their opinion, and also from a legislative perspective, answering some more ag aid, you know, questions that they and others have. And I've already promised sometime this weekend on ProFarmer.com to put out a updated summary of the EIDL loan program based on some of the language changes that we saw, and the same thing for the, you know, paycheck program as well, the PPP.
All right. Well, thanks. You both stay safe for the next week, and that'll wrap up this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.